From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the paradoxes of a global economy. We talk with journalist William Grider about his new book, One World, Ready or Not, The Manic Logic of Global Capitalism. Grider is the national editor of Rolling Stone magazine. Also, Sansaré Tate tells us about growing up in and later leaving the Nation of Islam. Three generations of her family were members. She's written a memoir called Little X. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the return of the sitcom The Naked Truth, starring Téa Leoni. ABC premiered the show originally. Now it's moved to NBC with a few changes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Two explosions rocked a building containing a family planning clinic in Atlanta today. The blasts were about an hour apart. Reporter Joshua Leves of member station WABE is at the scene.
There was an explosion coming from the back part of a family planning clinic in North Atlanta. Now, apparently, that explosion shattered not only the back portion of the clinic, but all of the windows in an office building, which is just across the street from it. About half an hour later, when teams of ATF officials were here, the FBI, police, and lots of media representatives, another explosion went off, this time in the dumpster. I could not have been more than 30 feet away. Many media people were right nearby. Debris was shattering everywhere.
Atlanta police say it appears the clinic was targeted. Atlanta Mayor Bill Campbell has dispatched police to other family planning clinics as a precaution. Strong freezing winds are paralyzing much of the Midwest. Snow is falling and creating whiteout conditions in some locations. Minnesota Governor Arne Carlson has closed all public schools because of the bitter weather. Wind chills are expected to drop to 70 degrees below zero today. Michigan is experiencing its worst weather of the season. Forecasters are calling for blizzard conditions across the entire state. One meteorologist is telling Green Bay Packer fans in Wisconsin that if they hold Super Bowl tickets, it would be prudent to think about leaving for the game now. The Israeli parliament has begun debating the agreement that pulls Israeli troops out of the West Bank town of Hebron. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from Jerusalem.
The Hebron agreement is expected to pass the Israeli Knesset by a comfortable margin. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had a much tougher time convincing his own cabinet to approve the agreement. After an often heated 12-hour debate, the cabinet finally approved the accord by a vote of 11-7. One of Netanyahu's cabinet ministers, Benny Begin, promptly resigned in protest. Meanwhile, Israeli soldiers are preparing to withdraw from most of Hebron. This morning, they loaded equipment, beds, and furniture onto dozens of army trucks and lowered an Israeli flag. Not all of the soldiers are leaving. Several hundred will remain in Hebron in order to protect the 450 Jewish settlers who live in the heart of the West Bank city. This is Eric Weiner in Jerusalem.
Today is the deadline for House Ethics Committee Special Counsel James Cole to complete his final report in the ethics case of House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Cole has spent more than a year investigating Gingrich and the funding of a college course Gingrich taught at two Georgia campuses. The speaker has admitted ethics violations in connection with the funding of the course and admitted giving the Ethics Committee inaccurate information about the courses. On Wall Street, the Dow is up more than 41 points at 67.68. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, Ford Motor Company announced today that it's cutting 1,300 jobs at its Halewood plant near Liverpool, England. Bloomberg's Juliet Foster reports.
The cutbacks will affect Ford's Halewood factory in Liverpool and are part of a long-term effort to revive the company's fortunes and recover its share of the UK market. In the third quarter of last year, Ford, Britain's biggest car maker, suffered record losses of $472 million at its European operations. The job cuts may be a disappointment, but the announcement ends weeks of speculation about the future of the Halewood site. The company will offer voluntary retirement to each of the workers and, after the year 2000, will switch production of the Ford Escort overseas. News of the cutbacks are a massive blow to both Halewood and the British economy, which over the years have both taken great strides towards bringing down manufacturing costs. In London, I'm Juliet Foster.
The Washington Post reports that the Justice Department is checking a plan to put Coke machines in the lobbies of 40,000 post offices. The paper says the difficulty is that Postmaster General Marvin Runyon has held more than $50,000 in Coke stock, and he was involved in the discussions. Runyon confirms the probe, but says he recused himself from the discussions and then sold the stock. A federal appeals court says CSX Corporation and Conrail can proceed with a shareholder vote tomorrow that could decide the fate of their merger. The deal is worth nearly $9.5 billion. The U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals rejected a request by Norfolk Southern, which is making a hostile $10.5 billion bid for Conrail. Norfolk Southern wanted to prevent the vote. Again on Wall Street, the Dow is up more than 41 points at 6,768. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology in
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, William Greider, writes about economic issues. His readers include people in finance, as well as people who don't usually pay much attention to the economy. He's the national editor of Rolling Stone magazine. He managed to take the usually arcane subject of the Federal Reserve and write a best-selling book about it. His book about the decline of American politics, called Who Will Tell the People, was also a bestseller. Greider's new book analyzes how the new global economy is reordering the world. It's called One World, Ready or Not, The Manic Logic of Global Capitalism. I ask Greider to describe some of the transformations he is seeing as a result of the global economy.
To write this book, I of course, traveled a lot, but to really only a dozen or so countries, what I think of as fronts in this revolution. We Americans, are now connected by the strands of the marketplace to some very obscure places. I was in a little foundry in China in a very poor rural village. They took me into the showroom at their foundry where they make the support struts for the engines of Boeing 747s. And they're quite proud of that. Boeing helped them learn how to do it, but they have capabilities of their own. I was in an industrial zone in Indonesia and talked to the young kids, and that's really what they are, mostly young women, who make shoes and shirts and various other garments that we buy as Americans. And one of my arguments in the book is that we're connected to these people now in a way that we really weren't 30, 40, 100 years ago.
Well, do you see people who had been poor, had been living in remote locations and are now working in these high-tech jobs, do you see them as being the beneficiaries or the exploited people in the situation?
What I try to capture is the ambiguity of their situation because the answer is that they are both. I went to Malaysia, which is probably the best example of a developing country, both moving up rapidly in its incomes and standard of living, but also with great, and I think not totally implausible, ambitions to become an industrial base of its own, even though it's quite small. And I went to the Motorola factory in Kuala Lumpur. I love this scene, and I think of it often. I'm standing in the hallway, the entranceway of the Motorola factory with the country manager for the company, and he's explaining things to me. And these young women, Malaysian women with the Muslim Tujung veils, some of them dressed quite conservatively and cloaked, shoulders to ankles, come down the hall, and the country manager greets them, "Good afternoon, ladies," and they sort of nod shyly and move on. And they pass by this panel of Norman Rockwell paintings. We all know them, the scene in the barber shop where they're watching the kid get his first haircut, and Thanksgiving dinner where dad is carving the turkey. And they all have business slogans underneath them, like, if you do the right thing, you will succeed, and stuff like that. And I thought, this is very strange. And they pass by this banking, this automatic teller machine in the hall, and the manager, the Motorola manager, explains to me, We had to change the culture. We had to teach these women to speak for themselves, because they're taught at home that they're supposed to take care of their husband and have babies and keep their mouth shut. And the banking machine lets them have their own cash. They had to go home and tell their fathers, I'm not bringing you the money every week now. I have my own bank account. That's a stunning, liberating, even revolutionary act of intrusion by an American company to introduce those values into the Malay culture. These women then go into a changing room, and a few minutes later they emerge cloaked in these jumpsuits, silky white jumpsuits with bonnets over their heads and surgical masks, and they go under an air blower which blows all of the remaining dust off of their garments. And they go into this sealed room, which I could watch through a window, and they go to these very complex machines and monitors, and they assemble semiconductor chips. And the semiconductor chip is, of course, the core artifact of our time. It's what's in our cars and radios and assembly lines and everything else. It's the core of this industrial revolution. Now, Motorola is a model employer in that setting, and the workers will say that. If they have to work for a foreign company, they would like to work for Motorola. On the other hand, the burgeoning electronics industry in Malaysia, where semiconductors, cameras, etc. are assembled by these young women, pays them about $130, $150 a month. That is not an income that you can raise a family on, even in Malaysia. And that's why these factories are filled with single young women. Their status in the society allows them to accept a non-living wage. In the Malaysian transaction that lured the U.S. semiconductor industry there, the government made a very explicit promise. This was 20, 25 years ago. If you bring your production here, we promise you, you will not have a union in the electronics industry. A few years ago, the labor minister in Malaysia said, well, maybe it's time to let people have a national union. After all, we have unions in other industrial sectors. And some of the U.S. companies said, if you do that, we're leaving. We'll move our assembly factories to Bangladesh or Vietnam or India or China, where the wages are even lower, and you'll be left basically with a development that proved to be quite parasitic and hollow. So I tell it in some detail because I think it captures the contradictions of this whole process. It is too simple to just demonize multinationals and say that they're trashing poor people around the world, although in some places they are. And it's also too simple to say, as the boosters do, well, we are helping these people climb the wage ladder and someday they'll be just like us.
You know, the really contradictory picture that you painted also helps explain why in some places the global economy is leading to a backlash against democracy, against the West.
Yeah.
I guess in part because of that cultural change that you're talking about. Women suddenly working and getting out of traditional costume, which for some people that would be a really liberating thing. Of course, for the males in that culture, they might not see it that way.
Well, and I think it is undeniable that given the opportunity, most people in the world, particularly the very poorest countries, will go for industrialization. But I mean, it's what our country went through. It's what Europe went through. It's what Japan went through. Why should we assume that these people don't want that? Of course they do. But given their weak position, they are extremely vulnerable to accepting terms that that not just disrupt their society, but in a sense encase it in the imperatives of the global system, the multinationals and the financiers, rather than their own destiny. And again, Malaysia is a wonderful example because they've been very smart and very forward-looking, and they still are. But there's an insecurity there, which their prime minister constantly articulates. His name is Mahathir, and he's a very interesting figure because he expresses the resentments that are felt in other Asian and countries, developing countries elsewhere, with a bluntness that others won't say. And he constantly rails at American culture. And for some reason has fixated on Michael Jackson.
What's his problem with Michael Jackson?
Well, Michael Jackson does this very erotic dance style. And you see it, when you see Malay kids doing the same dance in the streets, you begin to think, wait a minute, what planet am I on? I was in the Central Marketplace in Kuala Lumpur, which is a lovely scene because it's ancient in a sense, but it's also just a boom with modernity, these skyscrapers rising above you and people in the streets enjoying their new prosperity. And these kids were doing a kind of breakdance hip-hop routine in the dusty sidewalk for these patrons at a little outdoor cafe. And I swear, if they hadn't been singing in Bahasa, you would have absolutely seen yourself in L.A. or New York or Chicago. It was so American.
William Greider is my guest, and he writes a lot about finance and world economies. His new book is called One World Ready or Not, The Manic Logic of Global Capitalism. And we'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with William Greider. He's the national editor of Rolling Stone magazine and author of the book Secrets of the Temple, which was about the Federal Reserve. His new book is called One World, Ready or Not, The Manic Logic of Global Capitalism. One of the problems that you have with the world economy, with global capitalism, is that no one's in control. I mean, in the picture you paint, it's a lot of multinationals moving around, doing business around the world, and they're not controlled by governments, they're not accountable to anybody, is basically what you're saying. And yet the paradox there is that you say as individuals, the multinationals are each very insecure.
Yes.
As a group, they're maybe controlling the world economy, but each multinational is very insecure.
Well, that's a point that I think critics of the system will have trouble grasping, but I came to believe it. I talked to managers both here and corporate executives both here and abroad, and in Japan and Europe. And you can't listen to them describe the world that they live in without appreciating that those anxieties are quite real. They are driven themselves by a set of imperatives surrounding the price-cost competition, the battle for market shares, the technological contest to improve your processes and your product sort of more or less continuously. All of those elements of their life tell them, if we don't make these moves, if we don't close the obsolete factory or the older factory, if we don't go to Indonesia or China or elsewhere, we lose the race. And nobody is going to be sentimental about it. They will simply dismiss us. The multinationals, powerful as they are in fact supervised from above by finance capital. And if you follow the business news in the U.S. or Europe or Japan, you will see this played out in again and again. When IBM fails to follow the imperatives of the global system, the stockholders, the investors, dump their stocks, the price crashes, the management is fired. And then subsequently, tens of thousands of workers regarded as redundant are dismissed. The same thing has happened, of course, to Kodak and General Motors, to Volvo, to Daimler-Benz, to VW, even now to some Japanese companies that are feeling the pressure in somewhat different ways. My figure is that nobody is running this industrial revolution. The revolution runs itself. And that's both sort of exhilarating and frightening at the same time, I think. I think it's much easier for people to believe, well, there are a couple of guys in a boardroom somewhere doing all these things to us. And alas, it ain't that simple.
William Greider is my guest, national editor of Rolling Stone magazine. His new book is called One World, Ready or Not, The Manic Logic of Global Capitalism. Since you see global capitalism, global economy is basically being run by values of competition, you know, by the free marketplace, run by the multinationals, what role would you like to see governments take that they're maybe not taking now?
Well, I think you have to start with the governments that can do this, and I think ours is one. If we could somehow reverse the conventional wisdom of our policy elites, a nation state is not going to disappear because it's the only mechanism people have to speak to power on the global scale. And I think the U.S. government, for instance, has to refocus all of its domestic programs, in a sense, and its tax code, to focus on work and wages, not on pumping up exports or helping multinationals get into China, although they'll continue to try to do that, but to really focus on what's the state of the domestic economy and how can those domestic enterprises be encouraged. Secondly, it has to challenge the terms of trade, including labor rights, and require people who get into this system to begin moving up in their values rather than down. That's a very hard task and very controversial. I think it's doable, and I think you start with a few countries, a few rich countries, say the United States and some European partners, making a reciprocal trade agreement with a few poor countries, maybe Mexico, maybe in Latin America, maybe in Asia, and saying, look, we're going to show the world how this system can pull up rather than pull down. That's a hard political fight, as you know, but I think it's possible.
That also gets back to something you were saying before, that although multinationals as a group might be controlling the world economy individually, they're each insecure and kind of struggling to stay competitive. Individually, every multinational, I think, doesn't want to be weighed down with the economic costs of boosting wages and
right.
furthering social
sure.
values and having a, you know, a humanistic agenda.
Yeah, and
I think, go in there and just make money.
Yeah, and I think, you know, some companies are more virtuous than others, as we know, and I think they quite sincerely express their belief in human rights and so forth. But the fact is, this is a market system in which the virtuous get punished for their virtues rather brutally. So I think it's unrealistic to expect that the companies are somehow going to reform the system. They can't.
Oh, so you think the governments have to force them to?
Yeah, I think the governments have to force them to. And, you know, adopting codes of conduct is fine, but it's not going to change much because there'll always be some players in that same marketplace who scoff at the whole idea and go forward taking the race to the bottom. I think the other part about the multinationals is that, and this is true all across the world, but especially in Asia, a government that has the nerve and the confidence to assert certain requirements on those companies will be respected if the company wants to get into that marketplace. You know, when that factory in Malaysia I described has a really multicultural, multiracial management staff. And they explained to me the reason it has that is because the Malaysian government told Motorola it must include more Malay in its management staff. In Germany, General Motors or IBM or the other big American companies have works councils in their factories, elected councils of workers that have some connection to the supervisory board of the company. The reason they do that is because the German government makes them do it. In China, Boeing relocates pieces of its production there because the Chinese government says, we're not going to buy your airplanes unless you do. My point is that I think Americans are in some ways more naive than others about this. The multinational managers are realists. They're really not much in terms of ideologues. And they will do what they think is practical and necessary. So I think if the U.S. and others found the nerve to assert some larger values on this system, I think the companies, they would certainly fight them and resist, and they would grumble forever, but they would comply.
One more thing about the global economy. I'm not sure that I have the temperament to wake up in the morning and hear that the Japanese stock market fell and feel like that's going to affect me. You know, I don't know that most of us feel that there's room in our lives to worry about every aspect of the economy around the world when you're just worrying about keeping your own economy at home together and getting through your day.
Think of it this way, Terry. If you went back to 1890, when most economic enterprise in the United States, for instance, was very, very local, and you said to people, do you know that someday this grain in Iowa is going to be shipped by a major conglomerate based in Minneapolis with offices all over the world? Do you know that your local bank is actually going to be owned by another bank in New York or Tokyo or Chicago or whatever? You would have had a similar reaction, and it's quite human. There's no, of course, we can't cope with this now. And part of my message is that it is painful, it is difficult, and exhausting to try to take in all these new details of life. But alas, they are real, and the other side of absorbing them is that then you can begin to think about the possibilities for constructing a much more equitable, stable, peaceful world from the same elements. I don't say that that's going to happen. I think we have wrenching disorders ahead, mainly because I don't think the elites are going to deal with these problems. But if you went back to 1920 and said by 1950, by 1960, the American middle class is going to be broad and prosperous, and we're going to have full employment, and American society will begin to deal with some of its problems like race and so forth, they would have just scoffed at that as utterly far-fetched. But that's the possibility we have before us, is that kind of leap forward.
William Greider, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
William Greider is the national editor of Rolling Stone magazine. His new book is called One World, Ready or Not. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, growing up in the Nation of Islam. Sansaray Tate's parents and grandparents were members of the Nation, and so was she, even attending a school run by the Nation. She has a new memoir called Little X. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the return of the sitcom The Naked Truth. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Nation of Islam and its current leader, Louis Farrakhan, are frequently at the center of controversy. My guest, Sansaray Tate, has written a memoir about growing up in the nation. It's called Little X. Her paternal grandparents joined the nation in the 1950s because it emphasized African-American identity, offering a religion and culture with its own constitution, schools, and businesses. Sansaray's mother grew up in the Baptist church but joined the nation when she got married. She sent Sansaray to a nation school. Eventually, Sansaray's mother converted to Orthodox Islam, which more closely followed Muslim practices in Arab countries. Sansaray left Islam as a young woman. I asked her about what it was like to attend a nation school and how she'd compare what she was taught with what children learned in public schools.
Our history was different. We didn't learn, for instance, that Christopher Columbus was a great man who discovered America. We learned that he was a wicked man who came to this land and kicked some other people off their land. We didn't learn that our history began here as slaves in America. We learned that black men and women were kings and queens back in Africa centuries ago. How else? Our math and science was very advanced, I think.
Tell us a little bit what the school was like. First of all, you had to go through a security search, a head-to-toe search every day before actually entering the classroom. Why did such young children have to be searched?
Well, since the beginning, the Nation of Islam had been, I guess, I don't know if under attack is the correct way to say it, but under scrutiny, certainly. And so it was procedure that anyone coming into the temple would be searched for tape recorders, anything. This was just procedure. And this was all that I knew since I was a very young child, so it didn't seem strange to me.
What are some of the basic philosophies and practices within the nation, or what were they when you were a member?
When I was a member, some of the basic philosophies were, yes, that we were created in the image of God, that there was a God force in each of us, and that is something that has worked for me for the rest of my life. But there were some other philosophies that Caucasians are necessarily devils, and that raised questions with me even as a child, because there was one Caucasian in our neighborhood, Mr. Stevenson, and, well, his hair was brown, not blonde, and his eyes were brown, not blue. And he was a nice man. He hired neighborhood children. And as early as 8 and 10 years old, I was trying to reconcile how could all Caucasians be the devil and then this man be different.
Did you feel it was your responsibility to hate him?
No. Not my responsibility to hate him. I was just taught this basic thing that these people who look this way are necessarily evil. And I just couldn't, I guess, reconcile in my mind how that was necessarily true, but then this man was the way he was.
How would you describe the actual religion part of the nation when you were growing up?
Very intense, very strict. There was a dictate for every aspect of our lives. Chew your food 100 times, brush your hair 100 times, think 5 times before you speak, fast every 3 days. It seems like it was very rigid.
But what about scripturally? Did you read the Quran and the Bible?
No, our beliefs were based on the Quran and Bible. But we read Elijah Muhammad's interpretation of the Quran and Bible in his book called Message to the Black Man, because we didn't think we could understand and interpret the Quran and Bible for ourselves.
Did you grow up thinking of Elijah Muhammad as God?
Yeah, he said he was the messenger of God, and that's what our lessons taught, but we worshipped him as a god. We had a picture of him in the temple, the same way churches have a picture of Christ, and we saluted his picture upon entering the temple.
Now, you went to a Nation of Islam school until you were 10, until 1976.
Correct.
There was no extracurricular activities in the nation's school, no art, music, sports. Why not?
Because Elijah Muhammad said that part of the problem of our race was that we wasted too much time on what he called sport and play. Wasted too much time on entertainment. We needed to be focused on living better lives, women learning to be better mothers, men learning to be better providers, children learning to be men and women.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sansaré Tate, and she's written a memoir called Little X, Growing Up in the Nation of Islam, and she grew up as a third-generation member of the nation. One of the things you felt you were taught in the nation school and in the nation in general was self-respect. This is something that public schools would really like all their students to have now, and people are adjusting curricula to try to emphasize self-respect with varying success. What did you feel really helped you in the nation get a sense of self-respect?
Because we were expected to do well in school, and we didn't have a lot of programs to accommodate what a dysfunctional family or poverty or any of those things that become handicaps in public schools. We were told that regardless of our circumstances, I don't care if your grandfather died last week, when you come here, this is what you're expected to do. We believe you can do it. So do it. And then after you do and you bring home a report card of A's and B's, you feel good about it. And then you build on that, I think, and then you think you can do a little more, and you do, and you build one success after another.
The Nation of Islam school that you went to was closed for lack of money when you were 10 in 1976, and then you ended up going to public school. What was most surprising to you about public school?
I guess the laxness in our classrooms. I was on the fast track. I was in humanities in junior high school and high school. But so many other kids were not expected to do well. They were sort of just not expected to do as well. And I think that maybe if they had been, maybe they would have done better.
Were there activities in public school that you weren't allowed to participate in?
I couldn't be a cheerleader.
Because of the miniskirt?
Right. But I was a booster.
What? Didn't you have to wear a miniskirt for that?
No, we wore jeans and sweatshirts, and I still got to hoop and holler.
No, what about gym? What about wearing gym shorts?
I could wear gym shorts as long as my all-girl gym class was indoors, but when we went outside, I had to sit on the sidelines, and I didn't like that.
How did you dress for school?
Initially, I went to school in long dresses sometimes. Every day I wore a turban or a scarf, which left me sort of marked, I felt, because people's understanding of Islam then was mostly associated with what they saw on TV, terrorists and things like that. But by the time I was in, I guess, eighth grade or ninth grade, I talked my mother into letting me go out without my headgear on. I told her that it wasn't modest after all, that I was, in fact, calling attention to myself by wearing these clothes.
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I guess you were calling attention to yourself, even though those clothes were supposed to be modestly covering your body. How did she react to that argument?
Oh, she allowed me to take off the headpiece.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were fellow students making fun of you because of the way you dressed, or because that you couldn't wear gym shorts outside like the rest of the girls in the school?
Yeah, you know how mean kids can be. And so they tease. And one of my classmates in particular teased because when I explained to her why I didn't wear the shorts, and why I didn't try to sneak and wear the shorts since my mother was nowhere in the school to see me, I explained that because my dress code was something I wore so that boys would respect me. She said she didn't think the way you dress had anything to do with whether other people respected you or not.
So, what was it like for you the first time you put on shorts?
Oh, the first time I put on shorts and went outside, I was over at my cousin Serene's house, and I felt naked the shorts might have even come to my knees. I know I didn't wear the hot shorts that were popular in the 70s, but even with part of my leg showing, I felt naked.
When was this?
This was, I had to be maybe 11 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And were you doing this surreptitiously?
Yeah. I was over at my cousin's house for the weekend.
So it was a little rebellion.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sansa Rae Tate, and she's written a memoir called Little X, Growing Up in the Nation of Islam. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sansa Rae Tate. She's written a new memoir about growing up third generation in the Nation of Islam, and her memoir is called Little X. And Sansa Rae, you're now what, in your early 30s?
Correct.
You write in your book that you grew up not respecting people in other neighborhoods who acted like they couldn't keep their own neighborhood clean if the white man didn't help them.
Yes. One of the good things I learned in the nation was about individual accountability. And that you don't need a government program to keep your streets clean. You take your broom and you go out there and sweep the streets. You don't need a government program to feed your children well. You learn nutrition and you budget according to the money that you have. You don't need a government program to raise decent children. You take time and you discuss morals and decency with them.
You were taught a lot about what women should be like, what men should be like. You say in your book, your brother learned that your mother and all the rest of the women were put on earth to serve him, cook for him, and clean up behind him, whereas you learned that men were here to protect and provide for you. Elaborate on that for us. What were some of the things you learned that you were supposed to do as a girl?
As a girl, I was supposed to learn how to keep a clean home, how to plan balanced meals, how to care for children, how to run a home efficiently with a schedule, with cleaning, I guess, the living room, dining room, and bathroom on Mondays, and the basement and other rooms on Tuesdays, and cooking at, 3 p.m., and learning how to organize and run a household.
What kind of life were you taught to prepare for as a woman?
I was taught to prepare to be a good wife and mother. I was taught that the only way I would get into heaven would be through pleasing a husband. But early on, I decided that I was going to become a god-awful career woman.
Who'd you tell that to?
My mother, her sister, friends, my cousins, everybody.
What'd they say?
That I would learn the hard way.
Learn what?
Well, that men don't like independent women, that I was too intelligent for my own good, that God made society a certain way, and if women took care of their roles and men took care of their roles, then we would have a better society.
Did you feel that the boys and the men that you knew in the nation were respectful of girls and women, or that the women were taken advantage of?
I think, well, in my family, I felt like the women were respected. But I do know of cases, too many cases, where women with 7 children were left to fend for themselves. I know of cases where men wound up in jail and the women were left to fend for themselves. And I thought that was very unfortunate because the women sacrificed their lives and any career ambitions they had in order to be the wife and mother that they thought God wanted them to be. And then in the end, they still had to go out and hold down a job and raise a family.
What were the reactions of Christian relatives to your family being in the nation?
They thought we were crazy. My grandmother's father had helped to found a holiness church And for his daughter to go off and join this Nation of Islam, which didn't believe that Jesus was God or the Son of God, that caused quite a bit of friction in her family, and they didn't speak to her for about 20 years.
Your mother converted from the Nation to Orthodox Islam. What made her lose faith in the Nation?
She began asking questions, and like I said, though we were taught to be intelligent individuals, we were not supposed to question authorities, so that put her at odds with officials. She began to question things as basic as, on the one hand, we're condemning Europeans and everything about them, but then our men are dressing in European suits instead of African attire. Our economic system is based on capitalism rather than, I don't know, something else. But there just seemed to be so many inconsistencies. And then she realized that the corruption and exploitation that my father thought he might have escaped by being in this all-black nation was quite prevalent.
In what way did your father feel like he was being exploited within the nation?
Brothers were supposed to sell a certain quota of newspapers, and if they didn't, they were... Muhammad Speaks newspapers. And if they didn't, they were supposed to pay out of their pockets for them. My grandfather, at one point, had become distant from the nation because he refused to continue to pay for these newspapers that he was not able to sell because the nation was not even popular at this time. So you had men paying their family's bill money to pay for newspapers because they had a certain quota to meet, and that seemed like exploitation to my mother. You also had men working long hours at some of our businesses and not getting paid for the extra hours, but they were doing it because they were felt like they were building our own nation.
When did you start to rebel against Islam of both sorts?
I guess by the time I was a teenager, and my rebellion started as not wanting to wear these clothes because they made me a target at school. Some things just didn't seem to make sense to me. It seemed like too much was changing. I think because I had learned in coming out of the nation. Now, the nation experience was so intense that I was thinking if I ate potato chips, I might get sick or something because, like I said, our doctrines were so strict. You know, no pork meant no pork, not even foods cooked in pork, and we were always taught that consequences would be severe. So I'm growing up thinking that I have to walk this very straight line and believe all these philosophies and principles and lessons. And then at 10 years old, between the ages of 10 and 12, after Elijah Muhammad has died and his son is taking the organization toward Orthodox Islam, I'm learning now that, well, white people are not the devil, which is fine, but all my life I have been taught that this is so and this is what you need to believe and you better believe it to keep yourself out of trouble. So I'm learning that what I had learned was not true, that it was mythology, and that now we were going to pray to a different God and practice a different philosophy. And that was, so I guess I probably started rebelling back then.
Well, here's another thing that interests me about growing up in a new religion. So many people enter a new religion rebelling against an old one and thinking that in the new religion no one will have to rebel. You know what I mean?
And
somehow that cycle in many instances just continues of rebelling against the religion you're brought up to, whether it's an alternative or one of the real old ones.
That's exactly what happened in my family. My grandmother was about the same age. She was in her early 20s when she rebelled and left the church of her upbringing. I was the same age.
You were the same age when you left the nation. You were the same age as your grandmother when she left the Christian church.
Correct. And for the same reasons, because in her Christian church, she saw hypocrisy and corruption and the like. And then she thought she would not experience that in this new religion. But that was exactly what I experienced in this new religion.
Do you think of yourself now as an atheist, agnostic, a religious person who just doesn't necessarily go to a temple very much?
Certainly not an atheist. I love God, believe in God strongly. I believe in prayer. I'm comfortable in a Baptist church, in an Islamic temple. I found myself in a Catholic church over the summer covering a story, and I was comfortable there. And I see so many similarities between the philosophies. I just think it's unfortunate that we allow them to divide us in our communities and our families, you know, in our society. But yes, I do believe in God. I do believe in the golden rule.
Well, Sansare Tate, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me here.
Sansare Tate's new memoir is called Little X, Growing Up in the Nation of Islam. Coming up, the return of the naked truth. This is Fresh Air. NBC's Hot Thursday Night lineup gets a new addition tonight, The Naked Truth, a sitcom starring Teo Leoni, which last season was on ABC. TV critic Diva Bianculli has these thoughts on how the show has changed and why.
In the ABC version of The Naked Truth, Teo Leoni played Nora Wilde, a serious photojournalist who married well, very well, but eventually discovered her husband was seeing prostitutes on the side. She demanded a divorce, but proudly insisted she didn't want any of his money. Nora, it turns out, doesn't think that clearly when she's angry. His well-connected friends blackball her, so she can't get a job on any respectable magazine or newspaper. As a result, she gets so desperate for money that she accepts work as a photographer for a supermarket tabloid. First she hates the job, then she loves it. That was the premise of the show that aired on ABC. The show was very funny and fairly edgy, and Leoni was very funny and very, very sexy. The show had trouble finding an audience, though, but NBC was watching and picked up The Naked Truth as soon as ABC dropped it. Then came the network tinkering and the changes and the promotional blitz.
Now meet NBC's newest must-see TV Thursday night star.
Here she comes on Thursday night. She's on after Seinfeld and she's out of sight.
Ow!
The Naked Truth on NBC. The Naked Truth after Seinfeld. Thursday on NBC.
The spot between Seinfeld and ER, TV's two most popular series, is the hottest time slot on television. Suddenly Susan, with Brooke Shields, started there this season, but hasn't been able to hold the audience it inherits from Seinfeld. Last week, an estimated 6 million people who watched Seinfeld changed channels or turned off their TVs as soon as it was over. NBC wants to change that, and thinks The Naked Truth can do it. The old Naked Truth could have, but I'm not so sure about the new one. The reason NBC bought the show was to appeal to as many people as possible, so the network has made Nora what they call more relatable. George Wendt, the popular Norm from Cheers, has been added as the new editor, and his first move is to demand that the tabloid become respectable. His second move, reassigning Nora from photographer to columnist. In other words, NBC, in its infinite wisdom, has taken off Suddenly Susan, a sitcom about a young, single, and beautiful print columnist, and replaced it with The Naked Truth, which now is a sitcom about a young, single, and beautiful print columnist. It's better than Suddenly Susan, but Suddenly Susan would be better, too, if it had Taye Leone in it. If you're worried about Brooke Shields, her show will be replacing The Single Guy, an even worse Thursday night NBC show. But I'm more worried about The Naked Truth. I've seen two episodes of the new NBC version, and they aren't nearly as enjoyable as the ones from ABC. But the NBC Nora still has spark. I'm so impressed with Taye Leone's comic talents, I'll keep watching The Naked Truth on NBC, in hopes that it improves. But right now, I'm only 1 out of 6 million.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Barbara Bogave, research assistants from Siobhan Roth. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.